I don't know how much for how much longer I can stay there. So I will have to move back to Sydney at some point. All right, Peter, sorry, the question about you're a visual artist.
Yeah, I am a visual artist. I've always done art forever and ever. So, yeah, and I also work in, I'm an Aboriginal health worker as well, so study public health as well. So I do that and do art as well. I think that they both combine and they feed off each other. Art, well-being, all similar to me. And I get to be creative in my health work as well and do lots of visual stuff and work with younger queer mob as well to design things. And it's fun. I really enjoy it.
I remember some of your work. I know there's one here. This the dingo.
Yeah.
The dingo. Tell me about your relationship with the dingo. Why is that a metaphor for Peter Waples Crow?
The dingo's always been in my work since I was a young fella. People would sometimes comment that, oh, Peter, you've got no red dogs in your work at the moment or something like that. So it's just been constantly in there. But now it's become a symbol of myself as a queer native. For a while I was going through, and I have other nicknames like Wolf and all the wild dogs. I just love wild dogs. And I think I really love their connection to, in many cultures, as protectors of the underworld or the next connection of life as well. So I describe myself as really a spiritual person. I've probably always been like that. So now the dog, especially the Alpine dingo, which is under threat, it roams. My home country is endemic to that, but it's seen as a pest and it gets in the way of progress, which is like farming. It's not afforded the same protections as other natives. Often as a queer mob, I've felt that as well, but I'm not protected as well. I don't have the same rights. You know, we've got marriage rights now in a broader sense, but we didn't have them for a long time. But just that sense of protection and safety that you often don't feel. So that's the Alpine dingo has become a metaphor for that, the dingo as well. I'm also an outsider creature, you know. I'm Aboriginal, but sometimes I feel on the outside of that culture because of my queerness. I think there's lots of metaphors for it now, and so it's become just this symbol for me. People call me the dingo man or something, dingo head, or I've had other nicknames as well, but I just really love the dingo spirit as well. And sometimes I feel like I need to roam on my own, you know. I'm actually quite comfortable with my own company. And we've had, you know, dingoes in the past have had relationships with mobs as well, you know. And so, yeah, sometimes I'm with the mob, sometimes I'm roaming alone. So that's why it's become Peter Waples Crow, really.
Now, many people who are, you know, raised by their biological families in their, who aren't adopted, have a linear story. But your story unfolds in a different way. Can you maybe give me a sense of, you know, what was told to you or you know, how you present in the world?
This year, I've just had a show about adoption, so... And I find my closest friends, you know, my dearest sisters and stuff, are other people who Aboriginal people who've been adopted as well. I don't know, there's a connection between us and a story that we both share. And I've just had a show adopted, and I'm adopted, and I grew up in the Waples. I kept that name because I was loved by, especially by my mother, Peggy Waples, who sadly passed away when I was about 25. My story, but I didn't know I was Aboriginal. I didn't really get told that, but through my art and now reflected through some of my adopted cousins that I was, you know, always constantly doing blackfellow art and symbols. And so it's funny that the spirit is within you. So, and then there was a while there that I couldn't do that, you know, I think there was different times because of the age I am, you know, when cultural misappropriation or appropriation and issues like that. So I left some of that design behind when I went to art school and, you know, turned things into a more European style. But the truth would unfold, and I'd have to go and meet some of my blood family, which I did in my mid-20s. And one of the first things that my mother said was, we're tough because of our blackfella blood. So that just, I know, just opened my spirit again, you know. It went, yeah, you know, maybe, yeah. So, yeah, I think the rest of my life, and I'm constantly on it, is learning more about my culture. It's down in the high country area of New South Wales, sort of borders with the Wiradjuri Nation and, yeah, Narigu. I say Narigu because, yeah, Narigu or Narigo you might have heard of as well. So, but we're really the people of the high country, the snow people too, which I really love, because often people don't think of us as snow, mob as snow people, snow mob, you know. Yeah, we've got the desert mob and the saltwater mob and freshwater mob, and but we're the snow mob, and that's, you know, it's really precious to me. And the dingoes, an alpine dingo, snow dingo as well, you know, Mirigang. I guess
Mirigang is the word for, isn't the word for
dingo? Yeah, for wild dog. Yeah, Mirigang is the word for wild dog, and I've got the name, tribal name Nauran, which is emu. Like, there's an alpine emu as well. So, they're things that I have to look after as well. So that I paint them as well and include them in self-portraits. You know, it's been beautiful to reconnect, but my story has been about trying to reconnect, and being queer has sometimes been an obstacle to that as well. And I guess, you know, early on it was the HIV and AIDS epidemic that I had to confront first, you know, and maybe my Aboriginality went to a back burner and my queerness come to the fore, and there were too many people dying and nothing being done. And so the activism of that era really informed my artwork as well. I think I'm an activist, but in a quiet way. I think my art, I speak through more clearly than words, you know. I'm not, my spirit sort of comes out in that, you know. I'm finding the art I'm making now even much clearer, and I make it and then have to sit with it or see it on show, and then I can actually work out what symbols I'm using and what they mean. So, I mean, yeah, it's a lot of it's intuitive, and the dingo's just been there all along. But yeah, I think HIV and AIDS, and, you know, I ended up working in HIV in prevention, and in the 90s I worked with the mob in Redfern, in what was called then the Lane of Shame, because it was a sort of like a shooting gallery where people came to inject drugs. I'd worked at Beats as well, so I find myself in all these, yeah, I'm attracted to stigmatized health issues as well, you know, and minority, being a minority, being an outsider, yeah, I've sort of gravitated towards this stuff. I wanted to do stuff in, you know, as well, you know, to, but I'm influenced by Aboriginal activism and HIV and AIDS activism, and, you know, there's been works where they've combined, and protests around LGBTI inclusion. Yeah, I think they're really important.
Can we say, like, where did you grow up? Because we'll get onto the Sydney era. Yeah. But yeah, just as brief as you want to be about that kind of early part of your life, and then how you found yourself to be in a place, be in Sydney at the time that you were working in HIV prevention and health more generally.
I grew up in Wollongong. It's a rural, it's a coastal town about an hour and a half from Sydney. Thabal country, I think it is. But yeah, and it's, I grew up in a working class family in housing commission. But I was loved, and I think that's really important as well. You know, like I got lots of hugs and love from my mother. So I think that's really important for any kid, you know, especially if you're adopted. Yeah, we often talk in the adopted, like I'd say the adopted club, the people who have been adopted sort of get the picture that we were special, that we were chosen. And, but I think it's just love anyway. So that's really important to any kid. That tends to sort of shape your childhood, no matter what, whether you've got access to a lot of things or not, you know, love is sort of important. So I grew up there. Yeah, went to school there. Went to university and studied art, you know, and I was doing Indigenous motifs early in the 80s. And yeah, I did even did Indigenous social justice issues for my HSC.
This is before you knew.
This is before I knew. So I don't see how it was read, you know, like now I think back and think, oh, how would have that been read? But it was just... And I was doing queer stuff as well, you know, like, so I haven't changed really. And I've come back to around to me. And sometimes I think, you know, through the journey I've had through life, that I've come back to being happy making that sort of art again, you know, where it all fuses together. And just being a queer Indigenous person is amazing. And yeah. It's before I really knew, and yeah, and then I think it was a different time. There's a lot more visibility now, and back in the 80s and 90s, well, Aboriginal art wasn't really a thing until the 80s, was it really? Before that, it was seen as artifacts or, I don't know, you know, cultural belongings, we like to call them now, but yeah, it wasn't really seen as a thing. So I don't know how that was ranked, and I don't think I did very well. But I think it's pretty amazing when I think of what I did, and I love it. I just think I was more out in my art than I was in my real life. How people read me must have been like so interesting. But yeah, I didn't seem to care. You know, I had this form with two men kissing, you know, like, but they were made out of trees and, you know, all this sort of stuff. And then the social justice issues discussed death in custody, you know, there was prison, there was tourism, and, you know, I don't know, it was quite sophisticated, really, for someone who, it just shows that my family weren't negative, you know, they weren't racist towards it, you know, they just let me do what I needed to do. And yeah, so I'm thankful for that as well. But then, yeah, society tells you, you know, maybe you're not allowed to use this stuff, or, you know, and then because I was adopted, who am I, you know, then you have to go on a whole quest, you know. I'm not really a Waples, but I honour that still in my name, you know, just because of the love that they gave me. And I've adopted the Crow name, which is, you know, my great-grandmother from the mountains, Aboriginal woman. And yeah, since I did that, maybe later in life, you know, it's made a lot of sense, and brought me the two worlds together. And yeah, so
I think it's really important to say if we were loved by a family, even if it's, you know, mob don't like it, or you feel like you're, you know, not being honest, or you're being dishonest by saying that you were loved at home by your white family, and there's no shame in that.
I think sometimes people try to make you feel like shame, and maybe I felt ashamed of it for a while, like as an Aboriginal person, I'm like, oh my God, I got loved by my white family as well, you know. Yeah, and when the more I went on the journey discovering my Aboriginality, then issues came up in some of my sisters and brothers in that family as well, you know, like, what do we do? And some of the archetypes and that we all live in the bush and, or, you know, in the desert, and the othering, and then, you know, oh, what am I going to do? But that queerness had brought that up in the family as well for me. So I didn't have a great coming out, and I felt a lot of rejection, and so it was just another thing to be rejected by in that family. So, yeah, and then in my birth family, heavily affected by colonization and stayed on country, which is very different. You know, I'm only really reconciling all that stuff now, and it's going, they did their best, you know. You had to hide your Aboriginality in a lot of ways to survive. I think Claire Coleman talks about it, like saying the hidden generation, and claiming that as that's a valid form of survival, you know. It was just a valid form. It meant we didn't end up in some of the missions, but then we might have, you know, been lost a bit to Aboriginal history as well, you know, and the records aren't great, so that makes, you know, your authenticity can come into question. And but I'm really proud of them, and, you know, they're with me now, and the ancestors, I feel them, you know, on a spiritual level. So I often think, yeah, it's fine. They don't, you know, they're not thinking I'm queer, or they're not being homophobic. They're actually supporting me as this queer Ngarrigu person, and yeah, I love it.
I think we have to just accept that they love us and that we are loved by them. I said to you before, they're all constantly around me, and it's not a hard concept for black fellas to understand, that they kind of tell you in their own way, without using a voice necessarily. You hear and feel their presence, and they guide you, they guide your hand.
Yeah, I think just last night I was having a processing dream, you know. There was lots of things in there. I woke up feeling like I had processed something, you know. And the other thing is, here in Nam, in the city, you know, I'm living quite in the city, and I get rainbow lorikeet visitors, which is lovely, but the crows, they're a sort of a family emblem, so they always keep me grounded as well, and I always know I'm in the right place when I see a crow come by or land near me, or... And they often do. So it's like, oh, here are the ancestors presenting themselves. And it's probably why I'm really into the kin creatures of our countries. And, well, that's why the dingo as well, because if the dingo isn't doing well, then the country's not doing well. And if our kin, and they're not just, we're all related and all connected, you know. So that's why I probably focus on animals a lot as well. And I love painting them more than human beings. So, yeah.
Human beings are trouble. I guess this idea of the totem, and I resist the idea of that we all, if you don't know and don't have that cultural knowledge, what I think tend to do is I have found my totems, and I know that they're relations of mine, and our kinship system teaches us this, is it teaches us the totem is something you have to protect, and you can have a personal totem. Who's going to stop me? There's no council that says, oh, you can't have a totem. I've done it. And I've said to people who don't have one, you choose one. It's like you can be cultural in your own way. So he's kind of totemic, the dingo.
It is.
And the crow.
It is my look, it's a, I say it's like the totem that's found me, you know. Like, it's always been my work. Why have I always done it? I haven't questioned it. It's always, painted the red dog for such a long time. And I know they come in lots of colours, and I paint all different kinds of colours, but yeah.
Why is he red?
Huh?
Why is he red?
I don't know. You know, I did a project in the 90s when I was working for the AIDS Council of New South Wales in Wollongong, you know, the red dog project as well. And I'd actually been to Mexico, the Colomai dogs, you know, there's these red effigy dogs. They're ceramic, and they're sort of to represent the dog, which has a body temperature 3 degrees warmer than the human. So it kept the human soul warm on the next journey and became its companion. So, I mean, the red dog show was about that, you know, the red dog, more like a dingo, but being a companion to all the young men whose families and young people whose families had... decided to turn their back on them. And yeah, so, and I'd had that experience, you know, with a partner and the guy he was connecting to, you know, like not the partner, but a friend who he was caring for, you know, and the family really turned their back, and the word was that people died of cancer, not of AIDS, and yeah, they were just really ashamed of their, it was horrible, you know, there were some really horrible times in the 90s, yeah.
So you left Wollongong, or did you get on the train? How did you, was there a day that you kind of left?
No, I think I'd, I've lived in Wollongong, then I went to Sydney.
1990?
More around, I went overseas, you know, I think there was a point in 1990 when I went, I just sold everything I could and I just went for an adventure, for a backpack, you know, and landed in, a friend of mine, an artist friend, I was doing the artist life, you know, in Wollongong at the end. I just wasn't happy, you know, like maybe all that Europe suppressing the Indigenous stuff and not being really comfortable with it, you know. Like that's why it's so nice to be myself now and to be me fully and to be back doing stuff for the spirit and... I love it, you know, it's just, yeah, it's been a bit of a torture sometimes, you know, my life, you know, trying to reconnect and make sense of it all in a colonised country, you know, a product of colonisation, you know, so anyway, there was a disappointing time when I went overseas and I had a lot of internalised homophobia as well because... wasn't very supported and yeah, so I talk about that now in my health work, but I'm a sort of example of it where it turned into something horrible where you really hated yourself, you know, so and maybe my natural thing is to internalize things, I don't know, like even when I work now with mob, you know, I'm not out to hurt any mob, I don't want to do any more damage than's been done, you know, it's always been my motto, you know, so I don't know, I just suffered from internalized homophobia for a long time, so I couldn't, yeah, I don't know, I think the trip, I just went and became the person I needed to be and then came back to Wollongong after that, worked at the AIDS Council, met Michael, then we moved to Sydney.
Who's Michael?
Michael was my partner, first partner, Michael Gibbons, he was living with HIV. So we lived in a serodiscordant relationship in the 90s, which was very different sort of landscape to now. Some people said, you've got a death wish and all this sort of stuff. And it was horrible, you know, some of the horrible things that... yeah, and I guess that time too, you know. I'd lost contact with a bit of my family because... of really bad homophobia around AIDS as well, you know, like...
Which family?
Was it my adopted family? Yeah, yeah, so... And then, you know, reconnecting to mob with a queer identity was difficult as well, you know, with homophobia and... Yeah, the lens of Christianity sometimes really strong in some mobs and... Yeah, so... tussle. It was a tussle, just trying to find myself and be myself.
Can I ask, was there a moment that it was revealed to you that you were adopted, or were you always aware?
I was always aware I was adopted, so I think that's a better way, you know. For me, you just know it straight away. You know, I didn't, and out of respect of the parents, I didn't really do anything till Mum died. And I think I've been watching this show on ABC called Find My Family, which is all about adopted people in England, but there's a lot of common stories like about respecting. You didn't want to hurt your adopted family because you, I don't know why, you just have all these internal things going on. Like, I started more of my journey after Mum died when I was about mid-20s. So, but I was pretty lost for a long time, so.
And how did you start that process of learning more about your adoption?
You couldn't really access... I don't think it was till the 90s that you started to be able to access some of your records, yeah. But there was already enough clues around with a name and...
You had a birth name.
Yeah, the Wildsmith name. So, who is my mother, Lorraine Wildsmith? Yeah.
I mean, that's more than some people have.
It's heaps. I had more clues than a lot of people have, you know. And really, we started thinking we're going to find that name in the phone book, and because it used to be phone books, so you could look up that name in New South Wales phone book or wherever we heard they were down in that hills area, and yeah, we tracked it down on that. So, yeah,
through the phone book,
which yeah, but then I don't know. Then you've had this whole life being raised in the Waples, and then yeah. And you're an outsider to your birth blood family. So another symbol of the outsider, the dingo, you know, this dingo coming back. Yeah. And you've had your formative years or a big chunk of your life raised in another family. Yeah. So it's a mind blower.
And you live with it every day. It becomes part of your reality. Yeah. But it needs to be unpacked, and the way it affects you, You don't even know how deep that goes.
You don't know how deep it goes. And some adopted people, I don't know. I felt I needed to know a bit more, like who I was, you know. And I think I've spent my whole life doing that, you know. I think I'm in a happier place now and than I have been for a long time. I don't know what to say, Daniel. I just think it's very complex, and my life's been an adventure, you know, like of self, like not selfish, but just where do I fit in and where do I belong and how do I fit here? And, you know, now I'm queer, now I'm Aboriginal. This is not now I am. I've always been Aboriginal. That's the point, you know, I'm not Aboriginal now. And I took I wanted to understand what that really meant, you know, not like, oh, we've got black blood, what does that mean, you know? So just a little phrase like that triggered me off because, you know, I'd been so attracted to, my mother said, and I'd been so attracted to Indigenous stuff in art and even at high school and stuff, all the, not just here with Mob, but, you know, South America, see, that's another link to Mexico, like the Aztecs and all that. I was really into that and Indigenous culture there. Yeah, and I've had great experiences in life linking with other Indigenous mobs, like, you know, the Turtle Island mob, and I've been to health conferences, you know, and just connection, and yeah, it's been great, you know. I just think, blessed, I've danced in a powwow, you know, and... done a sweat lodge, and I wouldn't have imagined that ever, you know, growing up in Unanderra. So just, you never know what's going to be around the corner. So I think I've gone off track now.
That's what oral histories do. Yeah. They go over, you know, it's not, the time is not linear. It's not linear, the story, the human, our stories are not linear. And I find myself, you know, going, oh, darting all over the place, because life isn't like that. It's not really, doesn't follow it. One track. So you were drawn to, like you said, this kind of area of health, which was the most stigmatized. So that, so, you know, working in you know, shooting galleries, you know, where taking drugs was, you know, just what happened. So Redfern, working on the block, and you said something really beautiful about reviving. About reviving a person who'd had another black fellow who'd had an overdose.
Yeah, we used to do that on a regular basis. So I was, I don't know. You know, when I look back, you know, no one would. We were working in a lane, out of sight, out of mind. You know, working with the drug users and providing clean equipment, we were trying to get people to, you know, in a weird way, it was at sometimes that fixed needle and syringe programs, people come in, get clean syringes and then disappear. But here in a shooting gallery, you can actually watch people inject and their technique, and you can see where, you know, sometimes people, there's a swab used, an alcohol swab to swab the skin. Well, the mob were actually using it after, which promoted bleeding, you know, and so then blood was, the bloodborne virus was the way HIV and Hep C, you know, spread more quickly and through the injecting drug use population. So, yeah, we could do campaigns around that, you know, getting, you know, it was just, I don't know, it was sort of a real privilege, you know, but it was, yeah, it was also, like people would OD if the heroin was too good, and you'd have to keep them alive. And yeah, now people carry around some of the similar thing to Narcan, that which revives people, blocks the receptors and stuff. So, but in that day, we had to, in the 90s, you had to keep people alive. So
manually,
yeah, keep them alive, and
before the ambulance, you know,
could get there, you know. So I feel like I've really given back in that time, and I did that for a couple of years, but I think I inherited a lot of trauma from it as well, you know. So, you know, there was a lot of racism going on, and it was that time, there was, yeah, people were had enough, and the mob and the police were, you know, really full on, and it was just full on, you know. Yeah, we did our job down there, and you had little shifts down there, and sometimes you worked in the mobile site, and sometimes you worked over at Newtown as well in a bus, and you did deliveries to people, you know, they were all health promotion strategies to try to prevent bloodborne viruses amongst injecting drug users, and make sure people had clean equipment and didn't share, really. Mm.
This is that thing we call harm minimization, like just acknowledging that people are going to use drugs. How do you save their lives?
Yeah,
prevent other disease.
Yeah, prevent harm, and, you know, rotating sites and anything, you know, all the different aspects of harm reduction. Yeah, I'm a real harm reductionist, like taking a realistic approach to the world. We can't put our head in the sand, pretend this doesn't happen or move it here, but yeah, just work. It was great. And then people can access services, you know, sometimes, and then they might think about, you know, reducing their heroin or getting onto treatments options, or I think they're really important, NSPs, but they were seen as like the scummiest part of health.
NSP,
needle and syringe program, yeah, but they're really important. Been a big part of my work, even here in the Aboriginal community here in Victoria. I did a lot of work around Hep C, you know. It's a very stigmatised area because it's associated with injecting drug use. So then it's like, ooh, you know. But if you take a harm, it's like, no, people do inject drugs. You know, we've got to reduce the harm that happens, you know. So, I really focused on that. I think, you know, I too was injecting drugs and have end points in my life, and I think it was important to me, you know, as well, to help the mob and help my mob. Now I work in queer mob stuff, which is, you know, I'm always working in the areas that I identify really strongly with, I guess. And does that make you a peer worker? I'm not sure, you know, like it crosses over, but and even in working in HIV prevention and care and treatment and stuff, that was, again, a reaction maybe to my own life, you know. And then I found people working in sexual health and bloodborne viruses. There was a lot of queer mob working in that space because we were passionate about it, because we'd seen people pass away. We'd seen, you know, a legacy, a generation of people die from this disease, and we wanted to do something about it and felt passionate about it. So yeah, that was really important as well.
I always think on, you know, the advent of HIV and, you know, the AIDS pandemic, that time is often forgotten, or people don't talk about it because there's a lot of trauma associated with it. And those people aren't here, the generation that are gone, aren't here to speak for themselves. So, I mean, we have to acknowledge them and we have to say this happened. I remember the fear of being, you know, this always attended my coming out was attended by fear of death. So we were stalked by this spectre, this unseen, talk about the pandemic now, but we had, you know, true fear, and there was no real knowledge or support, or we were in it alone.
Yeah, I agree. I echo that entirely. A whole generation of us, that's what we had to come out to. You know, the coming out story involved, oh no, if you came out, you'll get AIDS and you'll die. You know, like that was what people thought at that time. And then, you know, I also heard the most vile homophobic stuff, you know, like, and then that, you know, Fred Nile, and, you know, that you deserve this. I think it really impacted on me as well, you know, as a young queer person, you know. So I thought it was horrific, the homophobia, and we should not forget about that, you know. So it was deemed to be, we know it was not just among gay men, but, you know, there's a bit of a hangover still, and that's the stigma of that time. And, you know, I just think I've come back in. I used to work for like an AIDS council in New South Wales, in Wollongong, in my hometown, which was pretty amazing, you know, in a lot of ways. And I used to be a beat outreach worker as well. That was another area of work where you worked at sexual health and STI and HIV prevention amongst men who had sex with men who didn't really identify as gay or... Yeah, that was, yeah. I think I've come from the lanes and the parks and the toilet blocks. and I made a health career out of it. It's been pretty amazing. Yeah, but a lot of people just, I don't know, it's these hidden worlds that people don't know is happening, you know? So
they want to pretend doesn't exist.
Yeah, just pretend it doesn't exist. But I'm like, yeah, I'm right there in it.
You're drawn to those, like, there's a high intensity and dangerous places are oftentimes.
They are dangerous places as well. But sometimes that's a bit of the appeal as well, to be a bit on the edge, you know.
Many health workers wouldn't volunteer to work in those places, but you're drawn to the need. Perhaps it's the area of greatest need or higher stigma.
Yeah, I think that's it. And that's always feeling like an outsider. Maybe I felt in there. That was my place, you know. So that's where the dingo, you know, and the dingo's following me in my art. And I was often commenting on beats and stuff in my art in the early days. And that, so sometimes as the outsider, yes, where are you going to go? Naturally, you're going to gravitate towards the areas of the fringes. And, you know, even in mob, the drug users are a fringe of the mob. And the, you know, LGBTI community can be on the fringe of the mob, you know. So that's where you'll find me, in the margins.
I think your health work is so important, and I guess though in Sydney at that time in the 90s, you know, I guess there was a sense of hope after we started to see fewer people, you know, dying in hospices, unaided and unsupported by their birth families. There was a sense of not of hope, but of just that there were ways we could prevent this. What do you remember of Sydney in that period of time? I'm sure you had a lot of fun. What was the vibration? What was the atmosphere like?
I'm drawn to 1996 or the Mardi Gras. You know, that it was just massive, and you know, we used to really look forward. I know it's World Pride, but it felt like Sydney was World Pride back then as well. You know, in the 90s. A lot of people came to the Mardi Gras celebrations, and I just remember 96, I think it was an anniversary or something, but I just remember that party, and I remember Sydney used to buzz, and there'd be all these new people in the city and, you know, it was
just hot new people.
Hot new people, yeah. and it was just, yeah, that's, I just loved it, you know. I had a lot of fun and I spent a lot of the 90s in a lot of clubs and with my posse of crew of people and, you know, different groups. I often think that was my dingo too, you know, exploring different subcultures within the queer community. And that's the dingo in me as well. You know, maybe not staying forever and ever in a subculture, but enjoying it for a while and then I need to wander off now. And yeah, so.
Yeah, that dingo is following us in this throughout this conversation.
Yeah.
I mean, I had to ask a question about him because he interests me as a metaphor for something else. I knew he was some kind of like person, a personal totem, but I thought there was a really important part of the story that would help us in this, in what we're doing. So I'm glad I asked that question first. So how did you walk away from Sydney? Was there a moment that, where you turned your back on that, or did you just, you found yourself moving towards gravitating to Melbourne?
Well, I'd, from the block, I got onto a public health program. It was a big leap, you know, and I'm not sure how I got on there, and on an Aboriginal public health program with a Bundjalung sister, Laysa, and we supported each other and went and moved to Newcastle for a year to do, to study. Then I came back to Sydney. Then I ended up on your country, on Bundjalung country, doing a placement at Lismore Public Health Office and ended up staying there for a couple of years. I really loved it up. You know, there's such a vibrant community on Bundjalung country. It's just, you know, it's beautiful. Lots of animals everywhere, you know, really. And I had a really special time there. But I felt it was all a bit transient as well. I don't know. And there are stories, I don't know the truth of them, but you go there to heal and, you know, there's a lot of all these things about the coast and that Northern Rivers area.
I believe in the power of the place.
I believe in it too. Yeah, I could really believe in it. Like, I really think I have a deep connection to your country. And it really took care of me. I had a really incredible meltdown when I first got there, like mentally. But then I found out I wasn't sort of alone, that a lot of people had. And it's just interesting when you have, you know, we talk about social emotional well-being and mental health. Yeah, I don't think people realised how unwell I was or something. And I was wondering whether it was a rebound from the drug use that I'd done in Sydney all the years. And but yeah, now I've got a diagnosis of bipolar type 2, so you know, it came and it took me a while to settle that down. Maybe I always have had this thing, and maybe I was self-medicating on some of the drugs, and even now I think about some of the party days, and maybe I wasn't as comfortable in the spaces that I thought I was, and I needed to be more, you know, on substances to get through. And yeah, I think more anxious than I ever was, more give credit to. I think it was a really, there was a lot of things to deal with in my life, you know, trying to reconnect. It wasn't always the easiest reconnection to the community. And I think we've talked a bit about that, you know, the complicated nature. Of course we're complicated, you know, and we're diverse, you know. It's like, yeah, sometimes, yeah, the binaries, you know, this and that. It's more, it's not just about binaries, you know. Anyway, I got there and had that, and then I stayed for 2 years, you know, so that was really cool. And but then I came back down to Melbourne, early 2000s, 2003, got a job at VACCHO. I'd come out with a master's in public health, so I really wanted to come and work in the community and think about Indigenous ways of doing public health in the early 2000s. And I thought working in a community control sector would be better, which is a whole Aboriginal community control sector across the country. for me to do that. So I ended up working for Vacho, and then I ended up meeting my next partner, who's just passed away about a year ago, Ian Kenny. You know, I was with him for about 17 years up until now. So he's been a really big part of Melbourne, and, you know, was lovely. I've just been working away at, I stayed at Vacho for about 11 years. Yeah. And I didn't do a lot of art, you know. I had the Victorian Indigenous Art Awards that I focused on each year, and I tried to bring a bit of queer into them as well. That was my other activism, you know, like, we'll put a bit of a queer bent on the entry award. And I did really well. Like, I'm out of the 10 years, I think I made the finals 9 times or something. And that's pretty amazing for someone who's not really consistently doing art. I'm honoured by that. And I won a few prizes, and I did, you know, a feature on the Dingo year. I think that was 2015 with the SOS, the Dingo, and all these text to works. Because I love changing mediums. I think it's, I don't know, I've got a love-hate with the art world. And sometimes I just want to keep not be commodified and just keep doing different things. And yeah, I'm still an independent artist, and I sort of like that as well. I mean, it's sometimes you think, would you benefit from being in the system a bit more? But, you know, I don't know. You just got to weigh it up. And my health job I really love as well. So it's a nice balance. And I don't know where I'm going. I'm drifting off. But I think, as an activist, my art always has something queer going on in it. So I think I did one around pronouns one year, and way before we even have discussions and stuff like that, because you meet different people, you know. Like, there was a non-binary person that I met, and we talked about binaries then, and like binaries of all kinds, you know, and go down the rabbit hole. And look, I'm really thankful for all the explosion in identity and the rainbow, you know. I sort of, as an older queer, I think even me reclaiming queer has been a nod to the next generation reclaiming it as well, you know, away from... Yeah, I was called a queer C. I was called, you know, I've had that used against me in horrible ways. But my activist nature wants to claim that back as well. So even though it might be problematic with some of the elders in the community who see it as derogative, I think it's important to just say, no, it's a word of activism, yeah.
I would say to you that all those young people who feel that freedom to express their gender diversity or whatever it might be, don't realise that people like you and me, anyone who went through a really hard time, made the world that we are in today possible. So we are a big part of, or unacknowledged part of, that freedom.
I totally agree, but I feel... Like recently, just even last year, we had a show, Rainbow of Tomorrow, with all the young queer mom painting. And, you know, they asked me to be in it as well. So I don't know. And I saw a lot of the young queer mob, rainbow mob, we could say rainbow mob, you know, at the Share the Spirit, which was on Survival Day the other day. And I don't know. I feel really
You feel really acknowledged.
Acknowledged, you know. I feel really acknowledged here in Annam, and I don't know, that makes me feel really proud, you know. You get your uncle name, and ankle name.
Are you okay with uncle?
It depends. I don't think I've got uncles and elders in my community, and I'm not, but maybe in the queer community, maybe, why not be like a rainbow mob elder, you know. Like, and I talked to Uncle Larry from Tanarong, and we were talking about that, you know, being community elders as well as not being traditional. So maybe all the little worlds and subcultures, you can have different, you know, honor systems.
So we're in, you're working for Vacho, you were working for Vacho for some years. How Did you go back to Sydney in that time? Did you have a strained relationship with the city? How do you feel about Sydney? And it's the focus of World Pride, has to be said.
It is the focus of World Pride, and I did have some, I did have some issues with it. Yeah, so I haven't really gravitated towards, I did a project, a theatre project last year in Sydney, and that was interesting. Look, I really, you know, Sydney's a beautiful city. Yeah, and I really had a lot of fun there, you know, and really had a good time in the 90s. And I feel like I can see, I just feel like we can honour some of the 90s parties and experiences as like a world pride as well, you know, and this, it's great that it's coming to Sydney now, and it'll be here. No, I still love Sydney. I like visiting it. I don't go there as much as I used to, but I often go back to Wollongong, you know, like, and I had to make peace with Wollongong, as, you know, growing up there with my identity hidden away from me, yeah. So then I had to go back. Because then people think, it's interesting. I was doing Indigenous art in high school. I don't know what people thought. I didn't ask them what they thought. You know, I just did it, you know, like it wasn't, I don't know, maybe a different time as well, and political awareness and, I think I went back there deliberately. Not that
many. To make peace? To make peace with it.
To make peace with the past. So that's been really good as well. I was even going be travelling up, but I've decided not to do that. It's just, yeah, I mean, I had a year of, you know, dealing with the grief and some health issues, some eye issues, and I drove to Shepparton the other day, and I thought, yeah, no, I went, after Ian died in last December, I went up to Wollongong as well, you know, so, but I think I was just stunned by the death and grief that I just, yeah, I was going to go back again this year, but I just decided to just have a rest for a while and set some more boundaries and just see where I'm going. And but when I went to Wollongong, this, you know, when I'm there, this is ancestors, a bush turkey came into the place where I was staying, and the people there had never seen a bush turkey. So, and the bush turkey has some meaning around shared stuff, and yeah, it's that bush turkey meant it's just the ancestors coming, you know. It was okay, you know. So I don't know what to say.
my last questions are about pride. Yeah. And like I don't think that word is just a word, it's not hollow, and you can't just say I'm proud, or you can't. You can pretend to the world that you can look proud, but what does the lived concept of pride mean to you as a black fella and as a queer?
The concept of pride, I don't know. I'm proud that I'm here now. You know, I'm proud that I'm here now. I'm here that I've had trials and great times, bad times, but I'm still here and I'm making art, and yeah, we've got our own festival here in Melbourne, the Midsummer, which is on at the moment. I've got some billboards and it's called Queer on Country, you know, so I'm just looking back at them, they're symbolic and they're talking at this, yeah, I don't know, that's what pride is to me, you know, just being kind as well, you know, being always trying to be really loving and try not to do harm, you know, when I don't, I don't know, it's not all about wearing a rainbow or glitter or, you know, it's about respecting people, it's about, you know, I just want a world where we're really respected as well, you know, and respecting our differences, respecting their diversity and understanding that diversity, you know. I think there's, a lot in that.
Yeah, it's not just an abstract concept or a word. I mean, to me, it's you can't claim that word unless you have done what you've done, and it's come from, you know, risen through your pride, or actually found your pride through trauma.
Yeah, I think I found my pride through trauma. I'd acknowledge that. But I never gave up, you know? Like, I just kept going. There's probably times when I could have. And I'm at a new point now. So I just, you know, pride's a lifelong thing as well, you know? Yeah, if you're having a... Mad times can change, you know, as well. You know, hold on and be resilient. I know we overuse that word resilience, but... keep putting that foot in front of another and just keep walking forward. And yeah, you never know what's around the corner. I used to think, you know, as an artist, my art wasn't blackfella enough, you know, so, but what is that? You know, I always ask that question, what is blackfella art? I guess we all can, you know. Yeah, and then one day, I won a prize at one of the art awards, and it was so amazing. But that, I don't know, I've just always made art as well. So if you've got a creative passion, just nurture it, you know, even if it, you can't dedicate it to it full time, you know, just keep doing it and bits of it. And with the ebbs and flows of life, you know, more and more, sometimes you'll have more opportunity to do more of it. And I don't know. That's what I'd say too. Creativity. Be aware, just what's around you. Be mindful. Yeah, and just go forward. Yep.
And how you love more deeply. We've all got to look within our own mob, within Blackfella mob, but also within, you know, queer spaces and queer community. I think there's no love. You aren't behaving in a loving or prideful way. I can't believe in the mirage that you're creating about pride or whatever it is, identity, if you behave this way towards me.
I don't know what to say to that.
I just think sometimes we can't be proud if our communities aren't making us proud, or just treating us in a way that doesn't make us feel proud.
No, I agree. We need to support each other, basically. Yeah, we do. Love more deeply. Try to look past your own, I don't know what it is judgment. With people. Judgment, yeah. I think I did one of those hold up post-it signs. You know, I don't want to be judged, because I've felt I've been judged a lot, you know, my whole life, you know. I wish that word, that judgment word, would just disappear, but yeah.
Actual judgment would disappear.
Yeah. Judgment, yeah, no, I agree. I don't mean that. But that word, the essence of it, and just judgment, yeah, it has to stop. So.
True freedom is the absence of judgment. So how are we all, how is any of us free if we are judging others and treating them with disrespect? So pride for me is a very complex notion. So I'm not 100%. I don't always support the idea of it without truly understanding what it means. Is there anything that you want to talk about?
Not really.
I feel like I've talked about it. You've had... They've all been long. They've all been an hour and a half.
Or
2 hours, 3 hours. Can I just ask one question? And that is about, you know, in writing the story of your own life, which you have to do, you have to put it back together in a way that makes sense to you when your life is... You know, your identity is diffracted or you're disconnected. So do you feel like you're still writing that story?
Yeah, I feel like... I think I am writing that story, and I actually feel good about myself. You know, at this time of an interview, maybe I wouldn't have done this in the past because I felt too fractured. And I think, you know, one of my preferred methods of art making is collage as well. So, I mean, there's been a bit of talk, you know, around it being a queer, as we piece together our queer lives in a heteronormative sort of environment, you know, and look for elements and things that resonate with us as queer people, but it's also an adopted story and connecting back to mob. And maybe that's why I'm drawn to collage as well, and fracturing things. And fractures don't have to be a negative thing as well. Light comes in fractures, and yeah, fractures can be beautiful. So that's all I'd say. But yeah, I think, yeah, my works have become more simple and bold. And I was wondering this year, and well, maybe that's not true. Maybe they become more complex, but they're often quite fractured. You know, the film I've got at the moment's like a fractured look at the mountains through YouTube, finding old YouTube clips and stuff about the Snowy Mountain and comparing the playground that it's actually perceived to be with this long culture that we've had there, and the snow songs in it, you know, that I've done, you know, reclaiming language, and that we're doing. So we're doing all this stuff because we were heavily colonized, you know.
Snow Song is the record of a song sung by, I think, a Ngarrigu woman, or
Yeah, it was, and not back in 1839, I think.
It was recorded.
It was recorded. And we've got to go and perform it. Yeah, on the country where it was performed. It was just so incredible. How amazing is that, you know?
What is she singing about in the snow song?
They're calling, the women are calling the snow on the moon, full moon, too. And they're talking about the snow as an important part, that it's needed in the environment. And we know that environment under climate change and global warming is really suffering, you know, and it's really precious and fragile, and the snow's part of it. Without a good snow season, the rest of the environment doesn't do well. So the song's actually calling for the snow to come. Yeah. And just please come, you know. So it was amazing to be part of that. And I'll always be grateful for being invited to be part of that. I didn't sing it because I'm not a woman, but I play the clapsticks and stuff on that song. And there was actually the research was done through the explorers' diaries, and we found the exact location. And there was actually an Aboriginal, it was on an Aboriginal, there was a site there too, you know, we had to negotiate with the non-Indigenous farmer to be able to do the song on their land. But they were really cool, and they came and filmed as well. So hopefully down, and that song's now been spread amongst the Aboriginal orgs I'm part of as well, you know, so and performed a few times. So it's about reclaiming culture, and maybe my life's been about reclaiming myself, you know, fully and more authentic. And maybe I got tossed away from there for a reason to come back with, I don't see it as, maybe I see it as some, maybe I wouldn't have done it as well, you know, on the country. I don't see my adoption as the worst thing that could have happened as well. So I know there's a lot of stories of people had bad adoptions, and but it's not all the narratives. So some of them, like I said, I was loved, and yeah, I don't feel any shame about saying that. Yeah,
thank you so much. I know it's hard to talk about stuff and hard to know what really oral history really means, or how you put your life into a few sentences. But I really think that we've, thank you for your honesty and your candor, and for letting me in and just talking to me.
Thanks, Daniel. Appreciate it. And sending love to everyone out there.